Property taxation. Obviously, a big component of property taxation is basis, which is essentially what you have in the asset that shouldn't be taxable. That's an easy way of looking at basis. And so we're going to cover the basis and holding periods of assets purchased, assets received as an inheritance, and assets received as a gift, and then assets converted from personal use to business use. So beginning with the basis and holding periods of assets purchased, this is how you calculate it. You take the cost of the purchase plus any debt that you assumed from the purchase plus any other expenses plus capital improvements. That's the basis of an asset purchased. And the holding period on the basis, or the holding period for an asset purchased, is the date of acquisition until the date of sale. And why the holding period matters is for capital gains, short-term capital gain versus long-term capital gain. You obviously want it to be long-term due to the more favorable tax rates. Basis of the holding period of assets received as an inheritance. So the basis is the fair market value of the asset on the date of the original owner's death, or the fair market value on an alternate valuation date if that's elected by the estate. Now, the alternate valuation date is the earlier of 6 months after the date of death or the date of distribution or sale of the asset, typically if that happens before the alternate valuation date. And so when you receive property as inheritance, your basis in that asset is the fair market value of the asset on the date of the original owner's death. The holding period for assets received as an inheritance is always long term. So if you inherit some stock and it's $100 when your generous benefactor died, then they elect the date of death, not the alternate valuation date, then your basis in that stock is $100. For the basis and holding period of assets received as a gift, there's two scenarios. One is where the basis is less than the fair market value, and then the other is when the basis is greater than the fair market value. So in the first case, when the basis is less than the fair market value, you take the donor's carryover basis and the donor's carryover holding period. So you basically get their basis and their holding period. If the basis is greater than the fair market value, then if the basis is greater than the sales price, and the sales price is greater than the fair market value at the date of the death, then the basis is the sales price, and there's no gain or loss to be recognized. If the basis is greater than the fair market value, but the fair market value is greater than the sales price, then the basis is the fair market value at the date of the gift. And a loss would be recognized as follows: the sales price minus fair market value at the date of gift, which is a capital loss. If some of this is confusing, I would look at the ninja notes on this in this area. It gets a little bit tricky. What about assets converted from personal use to business use? So you have personal use assets, then you start a business, another business use. Well, the basis in those business use assets is the lower of the adjusted basis of the asset or the fair market value of the asset on the date of the conversion. Use the lower of those two, and the holding period begins from the date the asset was acquired for personal use. Capital gains and losses. So we're going to go over the calculation of capital gains and losses for individuals and corporations. So proceeds, when you sell it, proceeds include cash received, property received, because sometimes it's a combination of cash and property is being exchanged. So cash received and property received at the fair market value, services received, fair market value, any cancellation of debt, then any selling expenses going with the proceeds. Subtract the adjusted basis of the asset sold, and then that's your capital gain or loss realized. If the holding period is greater than a year, then it's a long-term capital gain or loss. If it's less than a year, it's a short-term capital gain or loss. Now, the netting process for capital gains and losses. First, step one is you net your short-term gains and losses together, and then you net your long-term gains and losses together. How do you know if they're short-term or long-term? It goes back to the holding period. So assets that are held longer than a year, long-term, those get lumped together. Assets that are held for less than a year, well, those are short-term, those get lumped together. So you net all of those, and then you'll either have a net short-term capital gain or loss or a net long-term, and then you'll have a net long-term capital gain or loss. So step two is net the short-term gains and losses with long-term gains and losses. So you take your net short-term capital gain minus your net long-term capital loss, if that's the situation, gives you a net short-term capital gain. If you have a net short-term capital loss, but a net long-term capital gain, then you end up with a net short-term capital loss. If you have a net long-term capital gain and a net short-term capital loss, that's a net long-term capital gain. If you have a net long-term capital loss, but a net short-term capital gain, that's a net long-term capital loss. Just like what we were discussing with the basis calculations, I would look at the Ninja Notes on this topic, because that table is a little bit confusing and it's kind of hard to convey in an audio. But again, if you have a net short-term capital gain and a net long-term capital loss, then you have a net short-term capital gain. If you have a net short-term capital loss and a net long-term capital gain, then you have a net short-term capital loss. If you have a net long-term capital gain and a net short-term capital loss, then you have a net long-term capital gain. If you have a net long-term capital loss but a net short-term capital gain, you have a net long-term capital loss. I would stare at that and work through it mentally. Next, we'll cover the tax treatment of capital gains and losses for individuals. Again, this is only for individuals. If you have a net short-term capital gain, those are taxed at ordinary income tax rates. If you have a net short-term capital loss, you offset the net short-term capital loss from other sources of income and up to $3,000, then you can carry it forward indefinitely. If you have a net long-term capital gain, those are taxed at capital gains rates, which are more favorable than ordinary rates. That's why you always want a long-term capital gain. If you have a net long-term capital loss, you offset that loss You offset that net long-term capital loss from other sources of income up to $3,000, carry it forward indefinitely. Now for corporations, if you have a net short-term capital gain, then those are taxed at ordinary corporate income tax rates. If you have a net short-term capital loss, those are deducted only to the extent of capital gains during the year, and then you can carry them forward, or excuse me, you can carry them back 35 years and carry them forward 5 years. For a net long-term capital gain, that's taxed at ordinary corporate tax rates. Net long-term capital loss, they can be deducted only to the extent of the capital gain during the year. You can carry them back 3 years and carry forward 5 years. Types of property. There's three types of property: personal use property, business use property, and investment use property. With personal use property, gains are fully taxable as capital gains. Losses are not deductible. Business use property is segmented into ordinary income assets and non-current assets. Ordinary income assets are current assets, which includes inventory and accounts receivable. Non-current assets include buildings, warehouses, furniture, vehicles, etc. Investment use property. Gains are fully taxable as capital gains, and losses are deductible as capital losses. So that's types of property based on use: personal, business, investment. Then there's based on category. You have personal property and you have real property. Personal property is movable property, like furniture, trucks, cars, computers, etc. That's personal property. Real property, it's stuff you can't move. Land, buildings, etc. So if you can move it, if you can personally move it, it's personal. Situations when capital loss is realized but not deductible. Wash. So capital loss is realized but not deductible. Wash sale. This is when you basically sell a stock at a loss and buy it back again real fast. Those are disallowed and they're just added to the basis, but the gains are fully taxable. So wash sale loss gets added to the basis. Wash sale gain, taxable. Gains or losses on virtual currency. So let's talk about some taxable virtual currency transactions. Obviously, we're talking about like Bitcoin, etc. If you sell virtual currency for US dollars, the capital gain or the loss equals the cash proceeds, what you get, minus your basis in the crypto. Real quickly, I'll tell you a story that you don't care about. One time, someone emailed me and said, "Hey Jeff, I want to send you $20 in Bitcoin. And just as a thank you, I think you're super awesome." I don't think you said I was super awesome, but just as a thank you for Ninja I Pass, blah, blah, blah. And I had never had a Bitcoin or a fraction of a Bitcoin. I say, okay, thank you. Didn't even know how to redeem it, but it was in a thing called Coinbase. Okay. So it's out there for a few years. And then one day I saw that, that Bitcoin had just like exploded. I'm like, you know what? I wonder, like, figured out how to log into Coinbase and, you know, password reset, blah, blah, blah. And, my $20 and Bitcoin was now worth 100. So I cashed it out and I reported it. So again, capital gain or loss on selling virtual currency, cash proceeds minus the basis in the crypto. If you receive virtual currency for services, the ordinary income is the fair market value of the crypto received. If you're mining virtual currency, ordinary income is the fair market value of the crypto received. If you exchange one type of virtual currency for another, the capital gain or loss is the fair market value of the new crypto minus the basis in the old crypto. This all makes sense. You might as well substitute the word asset for crypto. Use of virtual currency to buy goods or services, capital gain or loss, fair market value of the goods or services received minus the basis in the old crypto. Non-taxable virtual currency transactions. If you buy virtual currency with dollars and hold on to it, if you send virtual currency to a different wallet or account of the same owner, it's a non-taxable event. Let's move on to depreciation and amortization. Depreciation on personal property, makers. The method of the depreciation matters. So if you do 150% double declining balance or 200% double declining balance, this is the calculation. So for makers 150, you take the original cost of the asset minus accumulated depreciation, get that number, then divide it by its useful life. Take that times 150%. For makers 200, original cost minus accumulated depreciation, divided by the useful life, times 200%. Now within depreciation, there's conventions. There's the half-year convention and the mid-year convention. And this has to do with depreciation in the first year. So for the first year and last year. For the half-year convention, you depreciate for half the year in the year of purchase and the year of sale. Mid-quarter, use the mid-quarter convention for all assets, if more than 40% of the total property placed in service in the year is placed in service in the last quarter. Depreciate from the middle of the quarter of purchase and sale. So essentially what's going on here is the IRS doesn't want people to basically backload all of their purchases at the end of the year. So people are like, oh, I have a big tax liability coming up. I'm going to go buy a bunch of new trucks and just get the depreciation benefit. And so that's why that 40% rule is in place. If more than 40% of the total assets acquired during the year, if it happened in the fourth quarter, then you use the mid-quarter convention. Otherwise, use the half-year convention. For depreciation life and depreciation rates, the two that I would memorize are one segment, which is computers, office equipment, autos, light trucks, etc. So office equipment, vehicles, like obviously all business use. Business use computers, business use vehicles, those have a depreciable life of 5 years. And you use Makers 200 for that. So just remember that. And the second one I would do is office furniture and fixtures and equipment. So like anything other than computers and office equipment, this is just like equipment that you buy just for the field, just for work, etc. That's 7 year depreciable life. And again, Makers 200. So computers, so office computers, office equipment, business vehicles, 5 years. Office furniture, office fixtures, just equipment that you use, whatever it is for business, 7 years. Let's discuss the Section 179 deduction. Now, when I scored my 92 on regulation, which I will mention as many times as possible because it was my best score. Darn it. And I'm super proud of it. So I'm going to try to humble brag as much as possible about that one. People ask, like, what do I need to memorize? Tax rates and all this stuff. When I walked into regulation and I scored my 92, did I mention I scored a 92? Let's not talk about the back-to-back 74s before that. Like, let's not talk about that one. Let's just focus on the 92. Yeah, I scored 74 in regulation, and then lost my FAR credit, and then scored 92. Right. Okay. I walked into regulation only having Section 179 expense and threshold memorized. All the other stuff, I didn't have it memorized. All the other rates. So take that for what it's worth. If I can do it, you can too. Type of deal. Section 179. So essentially, when you buy business use assets, you can depreciate it over time, but you can, in many instances, you can also Section 179 it and get that tax benefit this year because like saving taxes in 5 years from now when you're depreciating that pop quiz. What type of asset has a depreciable life over 5 years? We just talked about it. Computer, office equipment, truck. So when you're depreciating that that truck over 5 years, and great, you get that tax benefit 5 years from now. But man, like, money's a little tight. You want to save as much money as you can on taxes this year. So you want that 179. Now, the maximum amount that can be deducted for Section 179 is, I'm not going to tell you. The reason for that is because there are two amounts with 179. There's the, and if you want to see the actual amount, it's in the Ninja Notes. But there are two numbers for 179. And there's the base amount, and then there's the adjusted for inflation amount. I reached out to the AICPA and said, hey, you guys have two amounts going here. What should my ninjas memorize? And they said, what they told me was, the CPA candidate will have all of the information that they need to know in order to answer the question. Because, like, they're not in the business of updating these questions for specific dollar amounts every year. And they can't put the base year in there when everyone is memorizing the number that's been inflation adjusted, because then everyone will get the wrong answer. So what you need to know is, if your purchases exceed the threshold for Section 179, then for every dollar that your purchases exceed the threshold, your Section 179 gets reduced dollar for dollar. So I'm just using fake numbers here. Section 179 used to be $1 million. The phase out used to be $2.5 million. It's not like that anymore. It's been adjusted over time for inflation. But just as an example, if the threshold is $2.5 million, so and on the exam, they will give you the threshold, or they should. If the threshold is $2.5 million, again, it's not. Look at the Ninja Notes, see the number. But if the threshold is $2.5 million and your purchases are $2.6 million, well, you went $100,000 over the threshold. So your Section 179 deduction gets reduced dollar for dollar, in this case, $100,000, because it went $100,000 over the threshold. So if Section 179 maximum deduction was $1 million, it's not. Again, look at the Ninja Notes, but it's close. If it was $1 million and you went $100,000 over the threshold, then you can no longer take $1 million of Section 179. Instead, what is your max? That's right, $900,000. That's how your eligible Section 179 deduction works. So, and also, your Section 179 deduction cannot be greater than your taxable income. And you also can't take it on property purchased from a related party. Now, let's talk about bonus depreciation, which is a tax incentive that allows a business to immediately deduct a large percentage of the purchase price of assets instead of writing them off over the useful life of that asset. And it's allowed only for qualifying personal property, which is new or used, placed into service. It's not allowed for real property. Now, if the property is placed into service, or if it was placed into service in 2021 or 2022, you could take 100% bonus depreciation. But if the property was reduced, or if the property was put into place, put into service for 2023, then it's reduced to 80%. 2024, 60%. 2025, 40%. And 2026, 20%. So basically, starting in year 2022, it's 100%, then it goes down 20%, or by 20% every year. So 100, 80, 60, 20, or 60, 40, 20. So that's how bonus depreciation works. Just know that starting in 2022 was 100% bonus depreciation, but 2023 was 80, 2024 was 60, 2025 was 40, 2026 was 20. Of course, Congress will then probably change it before 2026. We all know that's what they'll do, but that's fine. And there's no taxable income limitation for bonus depreciation. And like Section 179, you cannot take it on property purchased from a related party. So let's talk about the order of depreciation. This is key. First, you take your 179 deduction, then your bonus depreciation, then after both of those are exhausted, makers. So earlier we were talking about depreciable life. 5 years and 7 years was what I wanted to focus on. And that's for personal property. Again, what's 5 years? Okay, you got it. If it's in an office, like computer, office equipment, or a truck, then that's 5 years. 7 year property was like office equipment. Now, what about real property? Well, if it's residential property, which is any building or structure where 80% or more of its gross rental income is rental income from dwelling units, so apartment complex, the depreciable life on an apartment complex is 27 and a half years. No, you can't 179 your apartment complex. For non-residential property, office building, warehouse, retail stores, it's even worse. It's 39 years. So residential, 27 and a half years. If you can't remember what it is, just picture someone who's 27 and a half, finally able to afford a down payment on their first house. residential. Non-residential, 39 years. Picture 39-year-old finally has enough money in the bank to go invest in an office building. I come up with dumb ways to remember stuff. Hopefully, my dumb ways are helpful to you. Amortization, Section 197 intangibles. These include acquired intangibles like goodwill, trademarks, franchises, government licenses and permits, patents, copyrights, customer lists, covenants not to compete, etc. These are amortized over 180 months on a straight line basis, beginning in the month in which they are acquired. So, how long do you amortize intangibles? 180 months. What about self-developed patents and copyrights? So those others were acquired. You acquired them. What if you self-developed them? You amortize them according to this schedule. If it's a patent, 20 years. If it's a copyright, then it's the life of the author plus 50 years. What about research and experimental costs? If they're performed within the U.S., then they're capitalized and amortized over 5 years. If they're performed outside of the U.S., it's 15 years. Business startup costs for individuals and corporations. You can deduct up to $5,000 in startup costs during the first year of operation. However, there's a $5,000 limit, and it's reduced dollar for dollar for startup cost expense exceeding $50,000. So similar to Section 179, if your purchases for 179 exceeded the threshold, then the expense is reduced dollar for dollar. If your expenses for business startup costs exceed $50,000, so let's say it's $60,000. Well, that's not a good example. $51,000. Well, you went $1,000 over, so then you would have to reduce your $1,000 expense by $1,000. So the most that you could deduct is $1,000. And if your startup costs exceed the deductible limit, the remaining balance is amortized over 180 months, which happens to be 15 years, depending with the month your business starts operating. Organizational expenses, corporations. Businesses can deduct up to $5,000 in these expenses during the first year of operation. However, similar to the startup cost, has the $50,000 threshold and the $5,000 limit, then it gets reduced dollar for dollar. And just like startup costs, if the excess is amortized over 180 months, 15 years. Finally, depletion. This is allowed for exhaustible natural resources like minerals, timber, oil, gas, like stuff that there's a finite amount of. There's two basic methods of depletion for tax purposes: cost depletion and percentage depletion. Cost depletion, you take the basis in the property divided by estimated total units times the number of units extracted. That's cost depletion. Percentage depletion is the gross income from the property times the depletion percentage. This concludes property taxation.